Gospel Tangents needs your support. Please consider donating to our website, gospeltangents.com. We'll use your donation to help produce other podcasts and professional documentaries such as this. Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Bennett. I'd like to thank everyone who listens to our podcast on your phone or iPod however you listen to us. For those of you who are watching on YouTube, I want to point out a special extra thing that we've done this time. I have some old public domain photographs of the Kirtland Temple that I think you'll find really interesting. We also got two special guests rather than one today. In addition to Dr. Mark Staker, I'll introduce Dr. Richard Bennett. He's a professor of church history at BYU. And we'll talk about the construction of the Kirtland Temple. How much did it cost? We'll also talk about the Mormon myth about whether the saints really crushed up their china and put it into the plaster of the Kirtland Temple. Is this really a true story? Let's listen in on our conversation. Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. My name is Rick Bennett. I'm here with my name twin, Richard E. Bennett.
Your
I'm Richard.
Counterpart.
Yeah, I'm Richard C. Bennett. My dad is also Richard C. Bennett. So there's at least three Richard Bennetts that I know. So this will be a little confusing. But I go by Rick. What would you like me to call you?
I go by Dick.
Dick? Okay.
Or Richard.
More formally. I checked out your Wikipedia page, so you'll have to correct me if any of this information is wrong. But I understand you got a PhD at Wayne State University. I think it was in history.
American Intellectual History, they called it.
Okay.
Also in public history, archival management.
Okay. And then where did you get your undergraduate?
I got my master's degree here.
At BYU.
In American history, okay. With Marvin Hill as my chair,
okay.
Professor Marvin Hill, whose work on Joseph Smith is quite significant. That's where I really got interested in the Prophet Joseph, with Marvin Hill. And then I got my bachelor's here in English literature.
Okay.
So I got my BA here at BYU, and my MA here at BYU, and my PhD in Detroit, Michigan, Wayne State University.
Okay. So how did the guy from Canada come spend all this time at BYU?
Well, I got my, like I said, my bachelor's here at the Y. My parents joined the church up in Canada in 1952 when I was six, and I sort of grew up hoping to go to BYU someday. I was the only Latter-day Saint in our whole high school there in Sudbury. Mm-hmm. So I came to BYU so that I could be close to the church and then served a mission to Texas. 1967 to 69. I remember leaving Canada, it was 30 below zero, and arriving in Dallas, Texas, it was 90 degrees above, and that was in February 1967.
Wow.
So I knew I was going the right place, or the wrong place, one or the other.
Now, you were president of Mormon History Association. Was that the one that was in San Antonio?
2014.
Yes.
Yep.
I remember that one well. So I'm sure that... Did you serve in San Antonio? Or?
I served in San Antonio. Wow. My first place was San Antonio. Yeah. So it was like coming home because MHA's conference in 2014 was just exactly where I served.
Oh, wow. Boy. That was a fun one. I'd never been to
San Antonio. 47 years before.
Wow. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I've really enjoyed a lot of your... talks about the temple, and that's kind of why I'm here today. I understand you're working on a new book about the evolution of the temple. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a culmination of a lot of research I've been doing on various chapters on the rise of Mormon temple consciousness in the 19th century. And the title of the book is tentatively The Wisest Course, taken from Wolfert Woodruff's comments about the manifesto, which are found in the Doctrine and Covenants, where he says, which is the wisest course to follow? So it's going to be on that topic. I haven't finished it yet, but we're making some progress. A topic like this is very challenging. It's right on.
Oh, yeah.
But I've published several articles already. It's going to be a kind of a summation of several of those articles, plus some new research I'm doing, particularly in the Nauvoo period.
Okay. Well, good. I'd like to kind of take us from Kirtland and Nauvoo to Salt Lake as we talk today. All right, well, let's go back to Kirtland a little bit. So the Kirtland Temple was, and I'm trying to remember, I don't remember the numbers very well, but it was incredibly expensive, especially for a group of poor saints. Can you put to, you know, kind of an idea of, in maybe today's dollars, what the Kirtland Temple would have cost the Saints back in 1830s?
The cost of the Kirtland Temple?
Yeah. Do you know?
Yes, we know that in terms of contemporary dollars, 1836 dollars, for the property and for the materials and for the construction, somewhere approximately $40,000. We know that the looking at what that would be today, you're looking approximately at a 50-to-1 ratio in terms of the dollar equivalency.
50-to-1, so that's like $200,000 today, maybe, or more than that.
$2 million.
$2 million. Oh wow.
Which I think is kind of a conservative estimate. Because a lot of it was donated labor. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of tithing labor. Sometimes men would contribute 1 in 10 days tithing.
Yes.
They would work the other 9 days, of course, and get paid for it. Many of them would, of course. So I think that's a conservative figure.
Okay.
I don't think it's ever been fully plumbed what the total cost is, but it would be in the millions of dollars for a church which had very little money.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. You know, there's a story about that the saints used to crush up their china to make plaster on the temple. Is that a true story? Or?
No, that's not a true story.
Okay.
That's one of those Mormonisms that have come through somewhere along the line.
No, I'd heard that in my life growing up, as many people do, how the saints took their best china and broke it and put it into the plaster, and I couldn't find any accounts where they had done that, but I did come across a couple of individuals who mentioned as children that they had gone around to the garbage dumps and picked up fragments for the temple plaster. And as I did archaeology out there, I worked under T. Mike Smith, who was our lead archaeologist on that project, and I was digging in the ashery pit. There was this 30 feet across, probably about 15 feet deep pit of ash, and I went through bushels of ashes and found fragments of ceramics after fragments of ceramics that had been swept up in people's fireplaces and brought there the ash, you know, as they brought the ash in, all the ceramics. And I thought, you know, why would they take their best china break it up when they have all this stuff here just thrown out onto the ground? As I went back to those children's adults' accounts of as children, going around and gathering up the garbage to put in the plaster, I thought, you know, this is how it was done. They went and got garbage just like these people are saying they did. They didn't break up their best china, which doesn't make sense for anybody.
So there
to
is
do.
A little bit of truth that it wasn't their best china, it was their worst china. There was stuff that
it was the broken stuff that they gathered up the garbage. And as I tried to then trace out, well, how did that story then get started? I was able to push it clear back to 1910. An individual who was looking at the plaster and saw these fragments of broken plaster and broken china and other things suggested, well, you know, they must have taken and broken stuff up to put it in here. And it kind of grew from that they broke up their china, and then they broke up their best china, and this great sacrifice.
There's no question that they sacrificed to build that temple, as did the sisters. And they sacrificed in many, many ways, whether it was, you know, boarding workers or cleaning clothes or mending clothes or all kinds of things. But
they did sacrifice to build that temple. John Taylor talks about the incredible sacrifice that they made to where it could hardly hold, you know, even the strongest men could hardly bear the burden of trying to build that temple with everything that they had to put in to doing that in their great poverty. It was a fabulous, fabulous building. Polychrome tower, multicolor. We tend to think of it as an all-white structure today because that's how it's ended up over the years. But it was everything that they could find beautiful. They bought sculpture to put in. They had paintings on the wall. They imported carpet, probably from Great Britain, that they put on the floors, and they imported the best window glass for the windows. And this building was a fabulous structure.
Nevertheless, it was a beautiful bluish tinge to it, and that would shine in the sun. Rising sun, the setting sun, because it is on a hill, you know, the Kirtland Temple. Although there's all kinds of forestry around it today, I don't know whether that was there then, but it was considered to be a beautiful structure at the time.
It took incredible sacrifice to do that, including the plaster. Even though they got garbage, they invented the plaster process. The temple plaster was miraculous to the extent that they had to invent a whole new process to make it. And Artemas Millet invented a way of taking the lime that was the base for the plaster, and they would break up materials, largely glass, broken window glass fragments, and broken fragments of ceramics and things that they would chip into it, put into that, to get it to look like granite. They wanted a granite structure, so the original temple looked like cut granite. They painted the lines so it looked like cut blocks, and then that those little fragments in it made it look like, you know, polished stone. And it was a new process that they patented. Although Artemas Millet invented the process, Jacob Bump, who was working on the temple as well, he went and got a patent out on it as a process. And so this was a whole they had to get revelation, if you will, and they had to invent a new way to do that in order to make it look like they had seen it in vision with those cut granite blocks.
Okay, so did it kind of like shimmer then in the sunlight with this?
The sun would shine on it, and you get a little sparkling from a distance, and it was quite a dramatic view from the distance.
Wow, that must have been pretty cool to see.
I
hope you enjoyed this excellent conversation. In our next episode, we'll talk about the vision of Elijah in 1836. Did you know that it took almost four decades for that to be canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants?
This is a classic case in church history of what I would call the reclamation of revelation. And in 1876, under the specific direction of Orson Pratt, many earlier revelations that were given in the history of the church, including section 110, which you're referring to, were finally put in the Doctrine and Covenants and canonized.
For more information, please subscribe on our website, gospeltangents.com, where you can get a transcript. You can also get one at amazon.com for just $3. Please subscribe to iTunes, Stitcher, or other podcast application, and give us a review so that others can find us. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you continue to support us here at gospeltangents.com.